Okay, welcome everyone to compiler construction. Last time we finished with the topic of how to build your scanner out of the components that we have generated from our specifications of a scanner, and then additionally introduced a few common things about grammars, derivations, and all that. And that was for the purpose of standardizing our way of specifying the next component in line in the front end of a compiler, which would be the syntactic analyzer, or also called parser. So in order to specify a parser, we would use context-free grammars. And in the same spirit as for the scanner generator, we were after some kind of generation scheme for the parser component. And for that, we need some kind of target concept where to translate our specification to. So, well, if you have context-free grammars already in the room, you can imagine that the machine equivalent of that thing would be a good idea to use for an implementation. So the implementation has something to do with pushdown automata, and that's what we're going to talk about today in the beginning of, and then we're going to introduce the first concept of a parser generator, or parser concept. So let's talk about the basics of pushdown automata. In general, what you have with a pushdown automaton is some kind of central control unit that has a finite control states. You have the input, like you did for the finite automaton, and what is added to the concept of all that compared to the deterministic automaton from which we come, so to say, is this component over here, which is the pushdown that gives the whole concept its name, which can be used in a last-in-first-out fashion. So you know applications for that maybe from theoretical computer science with this very classic example of detecting a matching number of nested braces, and that is something that you can do with a pushdown automaton. Here you will see a few other quite nice features of them. So for an example, let's have a look at what such a pushdown automaton looks like. So there is once again a notion of states. In our case, we denote states with numbers to disambiguate between them. We once again mark special states like the start state, and we also flag final states, in our case state 0 and 2. And apart from the state-based components, there's also the transition-based component. Well, it's just the transitions itself. And it's composed of, well, each of these transitions is composed of three parts. There's that's what you see in one line of that thing. So that is a transition of the pushdown automaton. It consists of three components. There's first of all the left hand part, which is consisting in a sequence of states. There's the middle component, which consists of an input symbol, and there's the third component, which once again is a sequence of states. And what is that, does that mean? Is the first component is associated with what is on top of the stack at that configuration of the machine. If that matches the top of the stack, and the input corresponds to what you have in the second component, then you replace the part of the stack that you referred to in the first component with everything that you found that you find in the second component. And that is for all of these lines. So that is a machine model. I think that might be a little bit unusual for people, at least when I had these theoretical computer science lectures, we had a kind of a different model in the sense that we differentiated between the states and the stack symbols. Is that still the case for theoretical computer science, or is it? Yeah. So we refrain from that here. We combine everything together, and since the state of the control is kind of modeled by the actual number that is found on top of the stack anyway, we just ignore any additional state or an additional control network and just say that that's all encoded already in the state number. And yeah. So that is what we put on the stack, and that's where we keep our state, so to say. So in that sense, we do not differentiate between pushdown symbols and states. Well, burger, like that. And the kind of the upper symbol of the pushdown or stack represents the state that our machine is actually in. And in our case, every transition consumes or modifies the upper part of the pushdown. So, all in all, what is a pushdown automaton composed from? Once again, in one place and formally, we have several components, five by the number. We have the set of states, Q. We have the input symbols, the set of characters. We have the start state as a specially flagged state from a set of states, Q0. We have certain particular states in the set of states flagged as final states. So these are, this is a subset F of the of all the states. And then there's the set of transitions. And you see me using the notion of set of tuples here. So they consist of a non-empty string of states. And the symbols of the input, or also no input symbol at all, and a possibly empty string of states as the replacement of the top of the stack. So that is all contributing to the concept of the pushdown automaton. If you let such a thing then run, what will happen is it will start with one particular state on the stack, which is the start state, and the input that you want to test for whether it can be consumed or not. And step by step, it will work on both of these components. So one of them will diminish time by time, that will be the input, and the other one will at times grow and then once again shrink. So these are the so that is the stack or the pushdown of the whole thing. So those two components, the pushdown and the remaining input, is everything that we need to kind of do a snapshot of what the machine is currently doing. So if we can capture that, we can anytime continue the computation and get the same result as we would have obtained by running it immediately. So that is considered to be a computation state. So this combination of a string of states and the rest of the input is considered the configuration of such an automaton. So let's have an example. once again returning to the things that we have seen already so far. So let's try it out on a particular input. So let's start with the initial configuration. We will put the initial state on the pushdown, which is the left component, and the remaining input, which is all the input that we're gonna try to consume on the input part of the configuration. And let's see what the whole system does. So let's try to do a computation. For that, we need to look at the transitions that we have in our transition set and decide which of them to apply to our configuration. We do so by comparing the top of the pushdown to each of the left components of the transitions. So we have to match this zero thing with any of those over here, and we see there's only one match that we can find. That is this one over here. So what we will have to do is we will replace the 0 with 1, 1 as the new stack content, and we also consume from the input. What we consume is the A. So let's do that. This will lead to that configuration over here. We have gotten rid of the first symbol of the input, and stack has grown. So, once again, same procedure. Compare top of the stack to those things here, and also check what we can actually consume. So, in our case, what we can do is match this one over here. Top of the stack is 1, and the first symbol of the input is an A, so that will be the thing that we will choose. So what we have to do, we have to consume the A once again and replace the top of the stack with the thing that we find over here, leading to that. And, well, as the important parts of the configuration, this one is the same as this one. We can repeat with the same step once again. We will match once again with this one here and obtain this configuration. Now, the parts that beforehand were 1 and A have now changed. Now we have the top of the stack being 1 and the input symbol B. So we can't select this one anymore for applying. So what else remains there to apply? Well, the ones that have B as their consummation part can be found this line, and that is applicable. That is one step too many. So these are these two, and they are applicable on different tops of stacks. So the first one is applicable for top of stack 1, 1, which is nice because that is what we have, and the other one would be applicable for 1, 2. That's not what we have over there. So, well, what we do is we will choose this one here and apply it. So we have to replace 1, 1 with 2 and consume a B. So that's what we do. This will bring us another variation of top of the stack, for which we only have one particular thing that actually can match. This will be this one over here, the 1, 2, and B fits us quite well. So what we do is we replace once again. So we only have one B in the input anymore, and replace also that. And with that, we have consumed the complete input and end up with only one symbol on the pushdown left. That is very nice, as that is also a final state. And with that, we can accept the input as one that is recognized by our automaton. Okay, that's nothing too special. It's just how these pushdown automata work. They can differentiate based on the top of the stack and the states that they find on there. And apart from that, they can modify the top of the stack. They can either increase it, decrease it, or just modify the topmost symbol. And apart from that, they can consume input. They do not necessarily have to, but in our case, they do. Okay, so in the process of running the whole thing, you have seen me already using a certain notation for the steps of the computation that was that particular symbol. That is a relation between the configurations of a machine on an input, and thus it's a subset of the set of configuration tuples. And it's not just an arbitrary set, not an arbitrary combination of configurations, but it's only a special sequence of combination, and it is the one for which we find entries in the transition set of our computer. Yes? Sorry? There can be, yeah. Well, you can just choose any. We can choose any what we want. I didn't say that this is a deterministic concept. So that's the magic of non-determinism. You choose one, and if you run into a non-accepting state in the end, you may try again. And you can consider the semantics of the whole thing as if you find one choice of computation steps that matches the input, the whole thing is considered to be matched. Okay, that should have been also already content of theoretical informatics, but let's go through the lines. Yes? Sorry? That is... one of the brackets is one configuration, from is a type of a configuration, and the square means that there's, from a typing perspective, there's a tuple of configurations, which means one configuration that goes into the next configuration, and thus what the configuration step is all about. Yes.
If we have multiple pushdown elements at the end that consume all the letters, we just look at the top.
I haven't. I didn't talk about that one yet, but you're right to pose the question there. It's a matter of definition. For our purposes, we consider only configurations with empty input and singular content of the pushdown as suitable for a finite state. It also has to be a state that is flagged as a final state. But yeah, it needs to be exactly one symbol. But you can kind of create these catch-all transitions where you have these, where you don't consume anything, but just rewrite the top of the stack in case you find the topmost thing is suitable for a final state, we would just erase everything that is that is left on the stack. Cool. Back to the what the computation step actually is. So there is the notion of the a computation step needs to be based on the transition set of pushdown automaton, which consists in these triples, and these computation steps need to reflect that triple in a certain way, particularly. if you try to relate it to this particular transition from delta that has a gamma and an x, if you find that gamma as the top of the pushdown in your configuration, in your source configuration, and if you find the x as the prefix of your remaining input, then you can relate this configuration to the configuration that has the same kind of base of the pushdown alpha, but has replaced its top of the stack with the component that is found as the third element of the triple. And apart from that, the tail of the remaining input remains the same, but that particular input symbol x, which was the prefix of the input, is now gone. So in case that you can find matches for those components, you can consider that as a valid computation step of the automaton with the transition relation D and delta and that particular input. Okay. So now that we know what a single step computation is, we can now extend the notion of one-step computation to a complete chain of computation steps that are connected to each other by matching target and source configurations, and consider them to be a valid step of a valid sequence of computations, and we denote that with the transitive closure of our computation steps. And when we start thinking that way about computations, we can now think about what the accepted language of an automaton actually is. And for that, what we do is we look at configurations that are valid final configurations. These ones, so they consist in states from the final states, small f from large f, and empty inputs. And the thing is, we consider all the words as valid inputs for this machine if we can start on these words from the start state of our pushdown automaton with the word on the input tape, and then consider our chain of computations, or a chain of computation steps, which is thought of a sequence of computations, and if it is possible to end up in the final configuration from the initial configuration, still needing to read the word omega, then this word omega ends up as being one that the machine accepts. So for your question with the choice thing, since these chains kind of branch every time that we have several possibilities of computations, doesn't matter so much, because it just needs to be one that reaches the final state, and then we're already perfectly fine. Okay? Good. So that is the language that such a machine actually accepts. So, that is just what we didn't say before. So now, on the notion of determinism and non-determinism, So far, we didn't talk about that very much, but actually, we have had the more general concept of the non-deterministic pushdown automaton. We didn't say that we need to have special preconditions on the transition set. So far, it was just an arbitrary set. Now, special non-deterministic pushdown automata can be considered to be deterministic pushdown automata. But for that to be, we need to have certain constraints on the way that the set of transitions is actually composed. So the things that that prohibit the deterministic execution of our automaton would be the ones where we have choice, where there's several possibilities that we can execute computation steps. When is that the case? The case would be whenever we have computation steps where the consumed input, for example, would be the same, and there also needs to be something with the top of the stack, particularly, of course, when the transition talks about the exact same top of the stack, we would have several we would have choice, but that is only one special case of the thing. The more general case would be that one transition talks about suffix of the top of the stack portion of another transition. So, in case that we have look at two transitions, transition one and transition prime, then if the parts of the stack, there are parts of the top of the stack that they're talking about, if they are intersecting, and in particular if they are, if one is the suffix of the other, then we need the consumed input of the thing to be different. If they would be the same, then we wouldn't know what to actually do in terms of computations. So that is the condition that we are after in order to make a deterministic automaton. And in our example, we can check whether that is a non-deterministic or a deterministic automaton. Well, what can we say here? We need to check whether there's top of stack references that are suffixes of other top of stack references, and well, there is one here for transition 2 and transition 3, and for these we need to make sure that at least they're not talking about the same input that is consumed. And yeah, in our case we see everything's fine for both of them. They talk about different input symbols. And of course, well, if the input symbol would be epsilon, that would also be non-beneficial, because in that case we would also, no matter what the other input is, we could also always perform the computation with the empty consumed input symbol, and once again we would have non-determinism. So yeah, that's what we need to make sure. So in our case, we already had a deterministic pushdown automaton. So all in all, now there is connections between between context-free grammars and pushdown automata, and a particular one is that for each context-free grammar, there is at least one pushdown automaton that can be built that has the same language associated as semantics as the grammar has. Do we know any actual approach to come up with a pushdown automaton for a context-free grammar? Do you have any idea of how to do that? Have you done such a thing already in the theoretical computer science? No? No CYK algorithm or something? You did that? Is it really? Which semester are you in, if I dare to ask?
Second master,
yeah, 2 years or something. Yeah. Well, it's a quite a thing that profits a lot from the notion of this non-deterministic automata, where you can just choose the correct right-hand sides of production rules to match your current input, and you piece them together step by step and try to match them on the next level once again, and in the end if you end up connecting everything to the root symbol or the start symbol, then you have found a derivation of the whole thing. Since there's so much non-determinism going on there, you would need to do all of these things somehow in parallel, or somehow restart these things a lot, and in the end what you get is your desired thing. You will end up with a derivation tree of a certain input that keeps to the rules from your grammar, but you will have a kind of nightmarish runtime for that. But I think for the purposes of theoretical computer science, it was only a way of showing that there is a way to relate them to each other, and that there is a corresponding concept, context-free grammar, or on the other hand, an automaton for that. That doesn't help so much for our case, because we need something that somehow is feasible to execute on a second-by-second basis, so to say, in the context of an IDE, for example. And the algorithm has to be somehow fast to do so. But anyway, we will have a look at the particular approaches that are out there, that are the most common ones. And turns out that there is two kind of large-scale concepts for that. One of them is out there to derive, to give you a derivation tree based on leftmost derivations of your grammar. This would be the pushdown automaton with the index G. That means that this is depending on the grammar that you're talking about, and the upper index L on there. This L thing, this is to signify that we're talking about the notion of leftmost derivations. Then there's the other kind of automata, which is automata, once again, for each of the grammars, it's a different automaton, and those are now associated with reverse rightmost derivations, thus they carry the R over there. So, let's dive right into one of them, namely the one for the leftmost derivations, which would correspond to the notion of top-down parsing. So the idea is to come up with an automaton concept for leftmost derivations, and the concept for that is in general the so-called item pushdown automaton. So all the concepts that we talk about have that general approach as its basic concept. What is the features of that? What we do is we try to reconstruct a leftmost derivation. We will do so by expanding non-terminals with the help of rules from our production set. And in case that we at some point expand something to a terminal, we will be able to verify that that particular terminal has been the next one in our input. We can verify that and consider that branch as being treated and continue on with branches more to the right of the whole thing and continue to verify. Yeah, that is, of course, once again, something that... We'll see. For that, we will have a look at the rules of grammars in a certain way. Since we need to expand and somehow verify what we have expanded, whether that was a correct thing, we somehow need to manage the parts of the derivation tree that we have already successfully matched with the input and the part that still needs to be matched. For that purpose, what we do is we introduce so-called items, that is, rules that are extended with bullets. So they look like that over here. In general, what you can imagine is that there's several ways that these things might look like. So considering that alpha, beta, and so on, gamma, that is a possible way that a production may look like. Feasible, not feasible, admissible places for bullets would be here, 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 and here. So between each symbol of right-hand side, at the very beginning of the right-hand side and at the very end of a right-hand side of productions are possible bullet places, but at the same time, it's only one of them will actually be used. The others are just might occur at some place, but are not valid at that point. Because why is that? Because we need to mark definitely what we have matched and what not. So we can only use one of these things. So that's what an item actually is. It marks the spot how far the rule has already been matched with the input. In our example, so we introduce an example. There we have these productions, and in the beginning we would start with the start symbol. I haven't mentioned what the start symbol is here so far, so S is our start symbol. So for that we would start the whole thing, and there is a particular derivation tree. I have filled in the parts of the rule, so to say, that is to be unfolded from that node, or is to be expanded from that node. So this S node will go the way AB in the next expansion. So we will have we will find nodes with A. That was not the one. We will find the node A there and the node B there. From there we will continue on. This will expand on A, so we will find A as the next thing, and B, so we'll find B as the next thing. So that is once again just a derivation tree. And if we follow all the possible item configurations that might occur during the process of trying to expand and match with the input, we will start with the item where we have the start production here, and the marker at the very left hand side of the right of the right hand side of the production. Then, in concept, we need to somehow match with the input at some point. So, for that, we expand the A, thus get some kind of connection between those two bullets. This is once again this concept of connections for automata states. So that is kind of transitions between those things. So we will reach that thing. Then we can match with the input. This will lead to something like that. Then we have finished matching the right hand side of that thing with the input. So we have moved the bullet to the right hand side. Then we will connect that to the parent rule, where we can consider the A part as being matched. So that part is matched, that one is not so far. So for that we have to descend into the derivation for B, which we haven't matched yet. Now we perform the actual matching, thus we can use the connection point, the bullet at the very right-hand side of that rule. So we consider that thing also as matched, and connect up there, and consider that as matched. So we kind of trace the way that the verification of the matching of the input with the thing that we have created as derivation, we trace how that is actually performed with these bullet points here. So if we translate that into an automaton, since we have these connections between these bullets, we can set up a system of transitions that works on special states of the automaton. These special states are now items of based on the grammar that we want to match. So you see an example of how that looks like here. So in order to be able to generically define what a start state and an end state of our automaton looks like, what we do is technically we add a rule for initialization of the automaton in terms of one particular start state and also an end state of the whole thing. And this S can then be the start symbol of the whole thing. So the transition relation now looks a little bit different. It doesn't have integers anymore, but instead it is made up from sequences of items. And what they do is they each of these transitions corresponds to one of these black edges that we have drawn in the image before. That is how the computation states are connected to each other. So what that turns out is that shows is, for example, that from such a situation where we have the bullet in the beginning of right hand side, particularly the bullet in front of non-terminal S, what will happen then is we will perform a transition. We won't consume anything on the way. There hasn't been an input symbol passed on that way. And what we will do is we will open up a new state on the pushdown, which will elaborate on how we think that this S will expand. In our case, the S will expand to... Oh, that was not the matching color. I wanted to use green. Will expand to this. Christ's sake. Why is that? Okay. Sometimes system doesn't want to behave. So that corresponds to the expanded S. We expanded because we had our marker directly in front of that. That was the next symbol to match with the input at some point. Apart from that, we keep the old item on the push down because we are not done with that yet. There might be still other steps to perform. In that particular case, it's just one symbol on the right hand side, but you might consider also a situation where here there are several symbols on there, and at some point we also need to descend into what B expands. So we still need to keep that complete thing on the push down, because later on we will at some point need to work on the situation that B still has to be expanded. So, well, that was probably not the expanding thing. That was, come on, that was, that is the expanding step. But we'll see that later on when we talk about how the pushdown automaton is actually composed. So there's several kinds of transitions to be found in the set of transitions. There is the ones that we have already talked about a little bit. That is the concept of the expanding computation steps. They consist in an item. In this case, it's generic version. This alpha or beta might be whatever you might imagine as a sequence of symbols, but the main thing is that we find that the bullet is in front of non-terminal of our grammar. In that case, what we do is we have seen that we will do some kind of step in the derivation tree conceptually, and we do that in the inner tree, not through a leaf. And in these cases, we don't match with the input. We will perform an epsilon transition. And what we will do is we will keep the original item on there because there might still be things to do with beta. But what we will do is we will expand B into a new item which has B on the left-hand side, and whatever there is as a production for B in our set of productions, we will put the right thing on the right-hand side, particularly what we find in there will be ending up there with the bullet at the very left hand, of the right-hand side, in order to associate that that part still needs to be matched with the input. So that's expansions, and we will generate all of the possible combinations for a particular grammar in order to come up with our automaton. So we will go through all the productions that have non-terminals in there, and all the possible variations of right-hand sides that are there for that particular non-terminal, and make them into expansion transitions of our automaton, so that we cover all the possibilities that are out there. Then, what else is there? There's the situations where we need to match the leaves of our derivation tree with what is actually found in the input. For that, we need to consume something. And that's what we can do with the so-called shift transitions. So they consist in top of stacks that have items for which the bullet is found in front of a terminal symbol. In these cases, what we do is we consume exactly the terminal symbol and then replace the top of the stack with a different form, which we derive from the form before. In which way? Well, what we actually do is we... The only thing that we do is we move... We move the bullet from the front of the A to the back of the A. So it'll end up after the A. And once again, since we need to prepare all the situations that we might find ourselves in, we will just spam our transition set with all possible shifts for all productions that we find in our set of productions. So we look up in our set of productions all productions that have a terminal in them and generate the shift transitions for them. And in a similar case, we need to, similar to the expansion case, we need to provide ways of reascending from a successfully matched part of our tree into higher up items. And we do so by somehow diminishing the number of items that are remaining on the pushdown. We can do so in the case that we find that on the top of the pushdown there is an item for which the bullet is at the very end. In those cases, we know that everything that that item stood for has already matched something with the input. So we don't need to perform any further matching in that kind of sub-derivation tree. So we can finish considering that thing. So what we will do conceptually is we will remove that part from the top of the stack and instead continue working on the thing that we have left there on the stack, which will be this thing over here. But since we have already dealt with a certain sub-derivation tree, in our case the one that dealt with B, we can carry over the information that we have dealt with B into our left item over here. And in a similar way as we have done with the shift, we can just move the marker one step ahead. So what we will conceptually do is we will carry the bullet one step further so that we it will end up after the B. And all in all, with that, we will perform a reduction of the number of pushdown elements from... we will just remove one in total. And thus, that will help in... reducing all the work that we have gathered so far. And in order, once again, to cope with all the situations that may arise, without any hesitation, just generate all the combinations that are possible for our grammar and reduce transitions for that. So, that will yield us everything that we need for an item pushdown automaton. So that's already quite good. Just as a side remark, because that will be something that we'll be talking about later on more often, items of that particular form are called complete items. They talk about a complete match with the input of that derivation already, so they are called complete items. So, these expansions, of course, since the bullet starts at the left-hand side, at the very left of a right-hand side of productions, and is shifted to the right, that corresponds to a leftmost derivation. We start working with deriving at the left-hand side, thus leftmost derivation. Still, expansions are, well, you see, for the choice that we have for how to expand here by introducing new items on the pushdown, that is based on what we have available as productions for the left-hand side, in this case, this B. So if there's variation in there, in the sense that we have multiple productions for one non-terminal, we end up with choice here. Once again, non-deterministic choice. So that is still a non-deterministic automaton that we get by that construction. So the item pushdown automaton itself is a non-deterministic concept. In case that we want to make sure that our construction is somehow correct, there's a few remarks on how you could achieve something like that. Apart from that, what we want to concentrate on now is more how we can come up with a deterministic concept from that now very generic but also non-deterministic approach. So, what is the actual problem there? Here you once again see the transitions of the pushdown automaton, in this case for our example. So, there might be non-determinism hidden in there. So, any idea what makes that particular automaton non-deterministic? Or just what productions, what transitions actually are causing the non-determinisms? 3 and 4 is the first proposition. Three and four?
Zero and one.
That should be all. That's everything. So why are they non-deterministic? We can just apply the definition that we had in the basics of pushdown automata. What you need to have is you need to have a suffix relation between the top of stack parts, and you need to have the same consumed symbols. And you see, well, how to do that? You see, these are completely the same, and these are completely the same. So that will definitely be conflicting, or that will be choice that you don't know how to choose from. So there's conflicts between those transitions. So that is something that we can't deal with so easily in our implementation. Remember, we still need to generate something that will be runnable as just a program component. So there are several ideas to cope with that. There's the concept of generalized LL parsing, GLL parsing. So what this approach is about is that in case we have a conflict, what we just do is we clone the complete configuration and do our derivations. One of the options for each of the clones that we have created. That seems at first a little bit out of hand, but turns out that you can somehow share structure of what you have in common a little bit, so that you don't actually have to clone your complete thing, but you can start with only cloning the parts, only creating new structures for the parts that are actually different, and try to keep pointers to the parts that you still have in common, and with that you get somehow at least partially efficient implementations. And GLL parsing is all about making these kind of cloned configurations somehow feasible for concrete computation. Another idea would be, what we do is we just try, and in case that we find that the input that we at some point derivate is not matching with the input that is actually available, we will just retract by backtracking and at some point change our choice to something different and try again. And repeat and repeat and repeat until we at some point arrive with either an accepting state, or if we have exhausted all our decisions. That comes with a few problems, especially when there's recursion involved and all that, but at least that is one of the approaches that is out there. And then there's the third idea, which is the recursive descent. So we just expand and expand and expand, but we don't just expand in a naive way, but we do so by peeking into the prefix of the input that we have to consume at some point, and decide based on what we see as input which choice we do. And with that we will continue on. That is what LLK or LL1 parsing is all about. It is parsing from left to right, trying to expand a leftmost derivation by looking at the first k, and in our case k is 1, by looking at the first symbol of the input, LL1. Okay, so the machine model for a parser in that sense now has as components the push down. It has the transition logic in there with the delta. It has the input, and as a special feature, what we don't have so far is a feature what we didn't have so far is the look ahead window. Depending on the actual concept of parser we're talking on, this might vary in terms of size. We might have an LL parser that is able to look into the first 5 slots of the input, the first 3, only the first. In our case, we will just deal with the first input symbol, but there's also concepts about more than one thing. And based on the state of the machine that can be found on the pushdown and the first symbol, what will happen is there will be a lookup performed in the look-ahead table that will tell us for my actual state and a specific symbol that we find in the input what the appropriate choice will be in our situation. And with that, we will generate a sequence of derivations that will be the result of the parser run. So the output consists in a sequence of derivation steps, which is just production together with the number of which alternative non-terminal together with the number of the variation that was chosen to expand. and that will be one of the pieces of the sequence that is our output. Okay, so for that, what do we do? Well, the work that we have done so far is not for nothing. So what we do is we take the item pushdown automaton as our basis, and we will try to improve that by just this look ahead table, and the look ahead table will act as a kind of a guide for the item pushdown automaton to help decide whenever there's non-deterministic choice in the original item pushdown automaton. For that, what we do is we consider the next input symbol to decide what the appropriate rule will be for the next expansion. And if that is possible for a certain grammar, then the choices that you have to do can be guided with such a look ahead table, then we call a grammar to be an LL1 grammar. More formally, an LL1 grammar is considered to be an LL1 grammar if, when there's choice in the grammar, meaning if there's two productions for the same non-terminal with different right-hand sides, alpha and alpha prime, and if in all derivations of the thing where alpha is somehow a part of the whole derivation, then if by looking at the first symbol of whatever is produced from alpha and whatever comes after A differs from whatever is produced from alpha prime and this beta, if there's nothing in common between those things, then of course the first occurring symbol there is an indicator for which of the alternatives had to be chosen at that specific point. And if that is the case, then we can guide our item pushdown automaton with these look ahead one tables. Let's have a look at an example. So that is a very simple statement grammar, so to say, with just choice and loops and other expressions. And yeah, so let's have a look at that. So there's one symbol for which there is actual choice. So that is this one over here. There's several right-hand sides to choose from for the production. And we can try to find an indicating look ahead that tells us which of those choices have to be made whenever we find an S occurring somewhere in our derivation tree. And by looking at that, we see that, well, we have for the first variant, if might be a token in the input stream, so if should be an appropriate indicator for that one. So that is one symbol, quite nice. It differs from the first occurring token for the second alternative, which would be while. They are definitely different. And then, well, there's E. We can't say per se what is the first symbol in E. It's still something that needs to be expanded. But in our case, E is very simple, and it just is an identifier at that point. So, well, identifier is different from the token if or the token while. So this will be an indicator for the third alternative. Thus, we have different indicators for all of those alternatives. Thus, it is sufficient to look at only one long prefixes of the input. Thus, we can say that the grammar is actually suitable for LL1 parsing. Okay. Good. So, let's have another example. And this time, let's talk about what can go wrong in grammars or in productions so that we are not able to cope with inputs in the context of those grammars. So, once again, we only have one symbol for which there is actually choice. So we need to talk about this one. Variation 3 has while. While is a unique thing in this, so maybe no conflict at all. E is still having the same first symbol as before, so it's ID. It's different from while. Fine so far. But now we run into a problem. Those two have the same first token. Well, unfortunate. So LL1 will definitely be out of the question. Now, how can we repair that? Maybe we can increase our look-ahead window by one symbol. So let's do that. Turns out that that the next token in line is bracket, opening bracket, bugger. That will mean that LL2 also is out of the question. Just looking at two symbols from the input, that's not enough. So we can continue to do so. So let's increase our look-ahead window by another one. Well, this is still not sufficient. Then there's the opening bracket. That's still not sufficient, so we have now a look-ahead of 4. Yeah, with that, we now have a different situation here with the S. We didn't talk about the S so far, but that is kind of a recursive thing. With the S, we will get the same indicator symbols that S had, which will mean that at that point, we will restart here at the beginning, and we will get all the same tokens as we had before. And no matter how far we increase our look-ahead window, no matter how many symbols we look at, there will be still a valid input for that grammar that we can construct that will just spam us with if left bracket, ID, right bracket, if, left bracket, and so on, so that there will always be an input that exceeds every finite input window that we offer as a constant there. So there will not be a constant value k for which we can set a look-ahead window such that we can parse all the inputs that would be demanded by that grammar. So this grammar is not LLK for any constant K. We would need indefinite look-ahead window, which is not a finite concept, thus not implementable. So, but enough of the things that we can't do. Let's concentrate on the things that we can do, which would be finite look-ahead windows. For that, we will talk about so-called first one sets, which means sets of token sequences of the length 1 that occur as prefixes of input. if you look at certain at all the things that can be yielded by a certain non-terminal. So for that, let's look how we could define that. So just concentrating on terminal symbols now. If we look at sets of sequences of just terminals, then it's pretty easy to say what these first one sets actually are. Well, in case that the empty sequence is in the set L, then we have to take empty also into our first one set. Apart from that, we just look at all the sequences that are part of that L and just pick the first symbol from there and put that into our set. So we will essentially just cut the first token that we find from our token sequences and consider that to be the first sets. So for our example here, the first sets for those things would be these. So first one of S would be either the empty set, the empty sequence, or we have to take the one length prefix of all the words that is generated from that. This would be A, and all that. So there will never be a B in there. So the yields prefix of length one is what is essentially meant with this first one. So if you just talk about sequences of terminals, that's still pretty easy to say. But in order to talk about what the first one sets of non-terminals is, we will need to do a little bit more complicated stuff. Especially, we need to talk about how to compute with these first sets. For that, we need to introduce what certain arithmetics on these first sets how those will work, and especially union and concatenation will be of interest later on when we talk about how to relate that to combinations of non-terminals and terminals on the right-hand sides, because, well, as you have seen in the part of the productions, there's these are the foremost elements with which we introduce the semantics of the productions. So, all in all, what is arithmetics on first one sets like? Well, first one sets of empty set, well, that will just by itself be empty. There's nothing you can cut off from in the empty set, so there's nothing left in there. So that would be the empty set. Then the first set of the union of two sets. Well, considering that there's elements in there, what you will do is you will just do the union on the first sets of each of them and be done with that. So that is just mapped directly to union on the first sets. What is a little bit more difficult is the concatenation of two sets and the first set of them, because now you have to take into account things like whether L1 actually has something like empty in them. So what you in principle would need to do would be to kind of nest the concatenation of the first sets of the particular sets and then perform a first set construction on the whole thing. And to make that more short, we will call that the one concatenation and introduce a new symbol for that, which is this concatenation symbol with a circle around that. And why is that? That is because we can implement that in a more a procedural way by just distinguishing two cases. So one concatenation between two sets of sequences will be defined as, in the case that the empty sequence is part of the language one, is not part of the language one, then this will just be language one. And in case that that the empty sequence is actually part of language one, then we will take language one into our final result without the the empty sequence, and because that will be the case where all the sequences from L2 become relevant. So these empty things concatenate to everything that is in L2 and kind of disappear, and just the L2 elements will be remaining in there. So we need to perform the union like that, and thus have a kind of convenient implementation of one concatenations. Okay. Good. So now we can start talking about look-ahead sets for of sequences of non-terminals and terminals, and not only about terminals anymore. And for those, we are interested in the first of the yield of that combination or that sequence of symbols. So that is the yield of the sequence of symbols, and the first of those is what we are actually after. Done, right? Yeah, well, that is not a kind of a productive way of defining what the first set of such a sequence actually is. So we need some kind of more implementation-oriented way of defining what that is. So in order to come up with something like that, we do a little bit of a trick here, and the idea for that is to distinguish between certain cases. Especially what we will do is, instead of thinking about how to compute first one of a non-terminal, we will talk about the case that epsilon can be derived from A separately. So we will talk about two sets, the set that contains epsilon in case that epsilon is derivable from A, and everything else that is derivable from A which is not epsilon. So these are the epsilon free first sets of A, and that is what we denote by this F epsilon of something. So this is the epsilon free first one sets that belong to A, and the epsilon part is covered with that one, with this one. So for that, we just say that this part here is something that you can somehow compute by just trying to follow to trace everything that it can be produced from a certain non-terminal, and I'm sure you will be able to find a way to implement this property in an easy way. It's just trying out all the possibilities in there that somehow lead to something like the empty production. So that should be possible. So that is something that we will that we will consider as being already as being computable and given for certain non-terminals. So we will call that the empty attribute for a certain non-terminal, and that is true in case that epsilon is derivable from that attribute. So if that is given, then the first, the epsilon free first one set of a sequence of symbols can be characterized by the union of the first free of the not first free of the epsilon free first one sets of its of its of its components, and you don't need to perform the union on all of them, but you need to take care that you you only do the union on the items of the sequence up to the point where the empty attribute doesn't hold anymore for your symbol. What does that mean? Well, you do the union on these symbols one by one. X1 union X2 and all, of course, always the epsilon free first set of them until you hit an xk for which the empty symbol doesn't hold anymore. Then you stop and ignore everything else that comes there until you hit m. So with that, you will be you can now see the epsilon free first sets as not a complicated concatenation anymore, but instead as a special inequality system, and it will have it will look like the following. We will have even equalities for the terminal symbols, and these terminal symbols will consist in themselves because, well, those will be the first one elements that we will see if we look at those things. So that's just easy. And then there's the non-terminals, and those will be supersets of the first of the epsilon free first one sets of the symbols from the right hand side of the non-terminal that we look at. So for those things we will introduce, for each of the right hand sides we will introduce one inequality of that form, always keeping in mind that we have to fulfill that property that we get from that line over here. Okay, so with that we end up with a quite large inequality system, because keep in mind that we have for each of these productions that we need to produce several of these inequalities, depending on how for how many of those symbols from the right-hand side the empty attribute or actually holds. So, in an example, here actually no production at all is able to produce epsilon, so this empty attribute will always be false, which will be quite handy because this will keep the inequality system small. So all in all, what we obtain from there is a very small inequality system, still having nine elements, which are these over here. So These are the ones that stem from the third production over here, where we can have int name or opening bracket as the first elements of f. And apart from that, we will have the ones that stem from here, which will connect the epsilon free first set of T with itself and the epsilon first free set of F. And then there's the one that stems from E. So that stems from those over here. And then there's this artificial thing that we need for technicalities. So yeah, that's not so important right now. So if we look at these systems right now, we could just throw a general purpose solver for these inequality systems at that. But if we look more carefully on those things, we see that they are made up from in a very specific way. So these inequality systems are very special cases where we kind of only relate a left-hand side variable with one right-hand side variable or with a constant. These are that's a very special case. That's not a general case of inequalities. And these are actually so special that they have a special name. These are so-called pure unification problems. If you look something like that up, you will see that in order to come up with a solution for this inequality systems, there's a way to come up with such solutions in linear space and time. So, for an example, in the world of these very abstract, just variable to variable or variable to constant inequalities. If we look at something like that, we see that we can draw a dependency graph between these variables involved there. So if you consider, for example, this variable 3 and variable 1, you see that in the graph between node 3 and node 1, you will have a transition. So this operator is actually turned into a transition in that sense. Same, you could, for example, interpret that thing as the transition over here, this thing as the transition between 0 and 1, and so on. The question is, how do you translate these ones? These translate into additional properties for the particular nodes of this thing. So node 0 is associated with this A constant, node 1 is associated with B, and so on. So you can create a kind of a dependency graph on that thing. Also, these annotated constants are also kind of dependencies of the nodes in there. And now what you can do is you can think about kind of the propagation of these constants into this graph following the directed edges in there. So for example, if this 1 is depending on 0, and since 0 is depending on A, then this A will also become a dependency for 1, for example. And since there's a dependency for that one, this will also be depending on 1 as well as on B, and so on. And so you can see that this is kind of a graph property that we're trying to compute there. And such a variable dependency graph has a nice property that you can compute how values distribute over these nodes quite easily by just computing strongly connected components. So you determine kind of clusters in which information is just circling around all the time. So for those things, you can consider all the dependent things as being dependencies for all the nodes in there. And apart from that, if you have built up the strongly connected components, everything you have there is just all that you can have there is endpoints which are not depending on anything. For those, you are already done with all the constants that can reach them. For zero, you can only assume that A will be a concrete value for that. But these do propagate to all the connected components that there are that they are connected with. So this A will propagate to this one here, and thus will be considered as also a value for all the nodes in that connected component. And in case that there's others over there, this will be transmitted afterwards. So what you need to do is you need to build up strongly connected components. You can do so. Well, how can you do that? Is there? Do you know how to do strongly connected components? I think that was the first time since 4 years that anyone still remembered that name. Thank you very much. So Tarjan, yes. So there's a kind of a depth-first search that you do there with a little bit of additional attribution on there, which keeps track whether you're going down or coming back up. And with that, you can essentially create these strongly connected components. Yep. 100 points. So, yeah. That is essentially a depth-first search, and depth-first search is kind of a linear thing on that. So if you're done with that, you have the strongly connected components, and you just have to go through all this, these connected components with starting with or just always picking one that doesn't have any incoming edges anymore. Consider them as done and propagate their values to everything that they are connected to. Remove them from the thing and iterate. And with that, you can propagate all these informations through the whole thing. I think you will do that in the tutorial at some point. So, but yeah, that's how you actually do this computation of look-ahead sets in linear time. In our example, what we will get is that everything is its own strongly connected component, and thus this propagates through the complete graph. And with that, we can get now look-ahead sets for all the non-terminals, for F, T, E, and S prime. And with that, we can go back to our example. And yeah, it's still don't know whether time is enough for that. Well, let's try. We can repeat that next time in case that time isn't sufficient. So these are the things that where we need guidance how to expand. And the thing is that we need to decide whether we want to expand with that right-hand side or that right-hand side. So it's a matter of what is the first symbol that you see on the one side and on the other. And, in our case, well, we have just the epsilon over here, and in that case we have the A. With the epsilon, we need a little bit of work to do, because if we have an empty string on the right-hand side, we can't really say just from that right-hand side what the look-ahead set that determines S will be, because that is actually determined by the places or whether, by the locations where you can actually find such an S. So we need to still work a little bit on our thing. In how would we do that? I think let's do that next time. It needs a little bit of explanations on that. So, how to do the look ahead table in detail, we will see next time. Apart from this, I would say I wish you good luck in the tutorial now, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.